The following is a Reels Channel and Podcast One production, available on Apple Podcasts and PodcastOne.com.
The truth is, most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and forget to change our brush on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So, what makes Quip so different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, while still packaging just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist-recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Next, Quip's subscription plans are for your health, not just convenience. They send you new brush heads on a dentist-recommended 3-month schedule for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror that you can also use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And finally, everyone loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O-List, named one of Time's best inventions, and is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, as well as hundreds of thousands of happy brushers who use Quip every day. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/MMMF right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free. Getquip.com/MMMF. That's GETQUIP.com/MMMF.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised.
During the hot summer of 1985, the blood of Los Angeles residents runs cold as a drug-fueled modern-day Jack the Ripper terrorizes the city.
This is the boogeyman, but this is a boogeyman that is real.
Dressed in all black, he quietly slips into homes under the cover of darkness, at first to burglarize, and then viciously assault, mutilate, and murder.
There were old victims and young victims. There were men and women.
He strangled people. He cut throats. He stomped one woman to death.
He was indiscriminate in the way he operated.
He abuses and terrorizes his victims and forces some to worship Satan.
He professed to practice Satanism, and so one of the ways he was going to show his devotion to Satan was through murder.
He tortures more than 25 victims and murders at least 13 before he's brought to justice. Behind bars, this killer gains rock star status and attracts his own band of misguided groupies, including one juror from his own murder trial.
It's the desire to be next to someone who is both famous and dangerous.
Who is this charismatic psychopath devoted to Satan and devoid of remorse? Meet Richard Ramirez, a.k.a. the Night Stalker, a loner whose only true friend was the devil himself, until murder made him famous. True crime books, biographies, blogs, and scholarly works have tried to dissect the mind of Richard Ramirez, the notorious murderer known as the Night Stalker.
Mental illness social worker Tricia Phelps.
Richard Ramirez inspired a degree of fandom that is not often seen in the mental health world.
For the residents of Los Angeles who lived through Ramirez's reign of carnage, the summer of 1985 was terrifying. Numerous headlines and TV news coverage about this serial killer kept Angelenos on edge.
Reporter Keith Sharon.
He was the thing you thought about before you went to bed at night. He was the reason you locked your windows and your doors.
Several feature films about Richard Ramirez have been produced, including 2016's The Night Stalker, starring Lou Diamond Phillips.
Richard Ramirez was the personification of evil.
Photographer Bill Alcoffer.
There are some people that we talk to that still will not be at home alone by themselves. They still are afraid to sleep alone.
Senior crime reporter Steve Helling.
Decades after this string of murders, Richard Ramirez is still iconic. His image is seared into people's minds when they think of serial killers.
This self-professed Satanist continues to fascinate. But why? Born as Ricardo Ramirez in 1960, Richard grows up in El Paso, Texas, the youngest of five children.
His family described him as an angel. He wasn't an outgoing kid. He was happy to be by himself, and he could amuse himself for hours.
But as Richard grows up, he slowly becomes traumatized by his father's violent abuse.
You haven't been studying, have you?
His father was known to have these bouts of intense explosivity where he would strike out at whatever child was available. There is even a story that's often told about him getting so angry and so frustrated that he beat himself. He, the father, beat himself about the head with a hammer.
In fifth grade, Richard begins to show promise as a talented football player.
And he was even the star quarterback on his junior high team.
Around the same time, he is allegedly diagnosed with epilepsy.
Richard! Ricardo!
Making matters worse, Richard was moved to another school. So not only did he lose his friends and his teachers, but he lost football as well.
In 1972, when Richard is 12 years old, his cousin Mike returns home after serving as a Green Beret in Vietnam. Richard looks up to his older cousin, who often brags about killing during the war.
When Richard lost football and lost his peer group, he ended up in a very isolated place.
Unfortunately, there was cousin Mike to fill the gap with vicious and violent pornographic images of women that he said he'd raped in Vietnam, photos of beheadings, just gruesome, disgusting stuff.
Having power over life and death is a high, Richie. It's gone, Mike.
The things that he's being exposed to are going to send him down a path that would not be for the faint-hearted.
Richard often hangs out at the apartment that cousin Mike shares with his fiance, Jessica.
Mike had already evidenced tremendously large signs of paranoia. One of those manifestations being that he kept a gun in the refrigerator.
You can't get a job, Mike?
After Vietnam, Mike remains unemployed.
I serve my country. And I'm taking a break.
Give me a break, loser.
Shut the hell up, Jesse.
What are you gonna do with that, Mike? Huh?
I'm not scared of you, Mike. You're a loser.
The fight comes to a violent end. Young Richard witnesses Mike shoot Jessica in the face.
The effect of that is going to be dramatic and lifelong. It also normalizes that the world must be this horrible, vicious, violent place where if I don't get them, they're going to get me.
After Jessica's murder, Richard changed. He lost interest in school, and he started smoking pot every day. And he was just 12 years old.
With the hope of a better life, Richard's family sends him to Los Angeles to live with his older brother, Ruben, whom they assume will be a positive influence. But Ruben teaches Richard how to steal, and they spend days on Skid Row.
Richard was exposed again to the very dark side of the world.
By the time he was 15, Richard had dropped out of high school, had experimented with LSD, and had upped his game when it came to burglaries.
Richard works at a Holiday Inn where he gets his hands on a passkey and uses it to sneak into rooms.
On one particular occasion, he came across a woman who appeared to be alone, became aroused, decided that he was going to rape her. Her husband came in, caught him in the act, beat him to a pulp, and had him arrested.
Richard is arrested for attempted rape, but the couple lives out of state and doesn't want to testify in court, so the charges are dropped.
I think it led to him feeling a little bit more emboldened, a little braver.
For the next year, Richard lives in motels and on the street. He gets by as a shoplifter and burglar, earning just enough to live and support a new cocaine habit.
He would go and fence the goods. He might say, I have 2 sterling silver plates. I need an 8-ball of cocaine, where they would make trades.
He steals cars and cruises the Los Angeles freeways. Richard searches for quiet neighborhoods where he can break into homes and make a quick escape.
He would hit a bedroom community that always had access to the 5 freeway.
Richard would also travel to San Francisco to see his friend Donna Myers, who he'd met way back in El Paso. Around this time, he also became addicted to cocaine.
Former roommate Dee Dee Gregg.
Richard Ramirez, in the beginning, was a nice guy. He was young, and he enjoyed doing drugs.
Richard Ramirez learns how to shoot up with Donna's son-in-law, Earl.
He was quiet, he was polite, kind. But he was kind of you could tell. He wouldn't stand up for himself in a fight.
In addition to teaching him how to shoot up, Earl also helps Richard improve his burglary skills.
Cash is king, jewelry nearly as good, gold, silver, whatever. If we can't get rid of it quick, it ain't worth stealing.
It's in a rush, it's an adrenaline rush.
Former roommate Sonny Gregg.
Yeah, you know, you don't know what's going on in that house.
Hey, what about these?
I said cash, right?
We know he was quite a successful burglar because he was able to maintain a pretty extensive intravenous cocaine habit.
As his drug use intensifies, Richard becomes more and more isolated.
Rick was just the kind of guy that listened to, you know, his Walkman.
He was very into heavy metal music, and those things, naturally, there would have been a drawing into dark clothes, dark themes.
In time, Richard adds PCP, known as angel dust, to his narcotic use. One particular evening, he shares the drug with a woman he meets on the street.
Thanks for scoring this.
Yeah, no problem.
Don't waste your time or your moves. I'm a lesbian, dude.
Huh?
Richard leaves, but breaks back in while the woman sleeps. And then viciously rapes her. Richard Ramirez's insatiable appetite for drugs, theft, and rape will soon overtake him and turn him into one of the most sadistic serial killers America has ever seen. It's the early 80s, and Richard Ramirez is a drug addict, thief, and rapist who has made the California coast his hunting grounds.
He was never arrested for burglary. He was never caught or even suspected.
But in 1983, when Ramirez is 23 years old, he's arrested for car theft and is thrown in jail. While there, Richard meets an avowed Satanist.
For months, Richard hears this man praising Satan. And this man tells Richard that even if he kills somebody, you don't have to feel guilty because Satan will protect you.
Richard emerges from jail as an even more troubled soul.
He was raised in a Roman Catholic church, and I think it would not be a large leap to say that he turns to Satanism because he had prayed and prayed and prayed to God for things to be fixed. And when those things didn't happen, he sought out something else in the hopes that maybe this something else, and in his case, Satanism, would fix it.
As he descends deeper into heavy drug use and Satanism, Richard's physical appearance changes dramatically.
Now, he was doing some pretty heavy stuff. He didn't care what he did to his body.
Persons like Ramirez, where we are dealing with some sort of psychotic disorder, it is not unusual that the first things that people remark upon is the lack of hygiene, horrible body odor, teeth deteriorating.
In the depths of his addiction, Richard becomes further estranged from his family. His sister Ruth makes the trek to L.A. from Texas to convince her baby brother to return home.
Richie, please don't do this. It's going to kill you. Just come home with me.
Not going back to El Paso with you, Ruth.
Why? You don't have to live like this.
This is my home, Ruth. This is how I want to live.
To her horror, when she got out there, she discovered that he was addicted to cocaine and was shooting up intravenously and became desperately concerned.
Richie, something bad's gonna happen. Please.
Nothing bad is going to happen to me. I'm protected.
By who?
By Satan.
And I think for the family, this was the first time they saw the psychosis that had started to develop around this belief that he was an emissary for Satan, or was acting on Satan's behest or behalf.
On June 28th, 1984, 79-year-old Jenny Vincow is assisted to her apartment by her son and then settles in for the night.
Jenny lived in a community called Glassell Park, and it had easy access to the freeway.
Richard, who has just bought drugs, makes his way into Jenny Vincow's quiet neighborhood.
High on cocaine, Richard cased the house and found a screen that he could easily pry open.
As Jenny sleeps, Richard rifles through her belongings. When he finds nothing of value, he becomes angry, pulls out a knife, and begins to stab.
Richard crossed the line, and it was vicious, repeated stabbing.
Jenny suffered stab wounds on her upper chest, her arm, and her legs. She had slashes on her hands, which showed that she was trying to defend herself, but she never stood a chance. Her throat was slit from ear to ear.
When you look at it from a psychological standpoint, these crimes at their very heart are deeply impulse-driven.
Months after stabbing Jenny Vincow to death, Richard buys a .22-caliber handgun. Fueled by a desire to kill, Richard goes on the prowl.
Richard steals a car and follows a young woman named Maria Hernandez. He follows her off of the L.A. freeway into her tiny community of Rosemead.
Just as Maria is about to close the garage door, Richard appears.
Lead homicide detective Frank Salerno.
She still got her keys in her hands, and he fires, and it hits her hand, and the keys deflect the bullet.
Miraculously, the bullet didn't hit her, but Maria had the presence of mind to fall down and play dead.
He steps over her and goes in to the apartment through the garage.
Inside, Maria's 34-year-old roommate, Dale Okazaki, is murdered in the kitchen.
Richard was on a shooting rampage, and when he came out the front door, he saw Maria, who'd come around from the garage.
Please don't kill me. Please don't shoot. Please.
And for whatever reason, he never explained why, and we don't know why, and he leaves.
Please don't go.
Richard leaves a living witness in Maria Hernandez. She works with police to develop a composite sketch of the killer, a man who's depicted as having a gaunt face and dark, bulging eyes.
Within an hour of his attempted murder of Maria Hernandez and his murder of her roommate, Richard Ramirez struck again.
Richard Ramirez next follows 30-year-old Taiwanese immigrant Veronica Yu. Veronica allegedly pulls over to boldly confront him. For the second time in one night, Richard's violent impulses take over.
That type of escalation is unusual in a serial killer simply because it's reckless and it puts them at risk of being caught or arrested. It shows how unable he was to resist the impulse.
You're not worth it.
Veronica Yu is found and rushed to the hospital. but doctors can't save her, and she is pronounced dead. Ballistics testing connects Veronica's murder with Dale Okazaki's from earlier the same night. After the murders, homicide detective Gil Carrillo consults with Sergeant Frank Salerno. Salerno, a veteran detective, led the task force that investigated L.A.'s notorious Hillside Strangler case in the 1970s.
They got these two murder victims, Veronica Yu and Dale Okazaki, and an attempted abduction on the same night, and the weapon appears to be the same one. I think it's the same guy.
Anything else match up?
Not yet.
My connection to the Richard Ramirez case started right after the Okazaki murder. 45 minutes after that murder, there was another murder in Monterey Park, and the same gun was used. So at that time, it was known that there were two cases that were connected.
You get more evidence, maybe we get more resources behind you.
All right.
Detectives will not have to wait long for the killer to strike again. 12 days later, they are called to the scene of a double murder in the town of Whittier, southeast of L.A. The victims are 66-year-old Vincent Zazzara and his 44-year-old wife, Maxine.
This case was vicious. Vincent was shot in the head while he slept. Maxine was also shot and stabbed several times. But the most gruesome part is that he had removed her eyes, and they were never found.
Richard seemingly enjoys killing, and he can't stop. While processing the crime scene, detectives catch a break.
In that case, he entered through a window in the backyard, used a pail to stand on, and climbed through a window. On that pail was a perfect shoe print in dust.
The print is from an Avia shoe. Richard frequently sells his ill-gotten goods to a contact on Skid Row.
Richard had taken a large number of items that he had stolen during this whole series of crimes.
After the Zazzara murders, Richard sells jewelry and a gun stolen from the couple's home. He uses the money to pay for a prostitute.
It's not working.
Just forget it.
No matter what he did, Richard Ramirez couldn't get sexually aroused.
The only things that seem to give Richard a release are rape and murder. A few weeks after the Zazzara killings, Richard enters the suburb of Monterey Park and into the home of 66-year-old William Doy and his 56-year-old wife, Lillian. Richard kills William and then flees.
Lillian Doy was an invalid who had suffered a stroke. But despite her condition, Richard Ramirez secures her with thumb cuffs and brutally rapes her.
When you look at somebody who is suffering with psychosis, all sorts of things start to break down in addition to their psyche, especially when you're looking at somebody whose psyche starts to become hyperfixated on one particular activity. In Ramirez's case, it would have been murder.
The monster behind the indiscriminate murders plaguing L.A. is a total mystery. But each victim reveals more clues, and police, witnesses, and the media are beginning to connect the dots.
Murder Made Me Famous. We'll be back after a word from our sponsors.
Let's take a minute to talk about your underwear. Yes, underwear. Everybody needs it. And new is better than old. And they have to be comfortable. So, you should get some MeUndies. MeUndies is the ideal underwear. They stay put, with no moving around, and they are delivered right to your door. They're made with amazing high-quality fabric that comes in so many colors and patterns, and you can get a matching pair for your partner. And this is a no-risk offer. If you're not happy, they'll refund the cost, and you get to keep them. Listeners of this podcast will get 15% off their first pair and free shipping. Go to MeUndies.com/MMMF. That's MeUndies.com/MMMF. And here's an extra gift just for you. If you order a pair, take a screenshot of your transaction and send it to gift@podcastone.com, and they'll send you another pair for free. That's one for 15% off, and then another pair for free. The first 25 people to send proof of purchase, either a screenshot of your purchase or the receipt, will get another pair for free. Just send your proof to gift at podcastone, that's podcastone.com, put MMMF in the subject line, and soon you'll have another pair in your collection. Order today at meundies.com/MMMF.
One third of all murder cases in America remain open.
He had told me that if I opened my eyes, he would slit my throat.
Each one is called a cold case.
The DNA evidence taken from the victim was a match. The Linen rapist was at it again.
Based on the hit A&E television program.
A phone call is placed, one that changes a family's life forever.
Cold Case Files, the podcast.
If you could see the fire in his eyes, he screamed at me, "You want it? Get your tape recorder out."
Download new episodes every Tuesday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app. Or Apple Podcasts.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised.
In the mid-80s, Richard Ramirez terrorizes Southern California by creeping into houses. He then rapes, beats, and kills anyone he happens to find. Complicating the investigation is the fact that the murders are occurring all over the LA metropolitan area and across numerous police jurisdictions.
Within Los Angeles County, you probably have another 35 or 40 small cities that have their own police department.
But when another Avia shoe print is found at the scene of the Doi attacks, investigators begin to believe there's a serial killer on the loose.
I think Gil is right. It's just one guy. And if so, his crimes are ramping up. The abductions, rapes, all the killings from different jurisdictions.
We got matching shoe prints, thumb cuffs, and several victims citing the assailant's bad odor.
So let's get to work.
A killer who can seemingly strike anyone and anywhere becomes a frequent topic of the local news.
The media that was covering this story called him either the walk-in killer or the valley intruder. But either way, he struck again, and this one was horrifying and heartless.
83-year-old Mabel Bell and her 81-year-old invalid sister, Nettie Lang, live in the small town of Monrovia, 20 miles northeast of L.A. While the sisters sleep, Richard looks for a weapon. He settles on a hammer and also picks up an alarm clock on his way to the room.
An alarm clock that he had stepped on and pulled out the cord and used it as a ligature.
Richard uses the hammer to bludgeon his victims to death. For the first time, he also leaves behind a specific calling card in the form of a pentagram.
Richard decided that one of the ways he was going to show his devotion to Satan was through murder.
One was written on one of their legs. One was on a wall. With each case, he's telling us more about himself on purpose or by accident.
One accidental clue left behind is the alarm clock that Richard had stepped on and used in the murders.
And on that clock was a partial shoe print of the Avia.
It's the same shoe print found at the Zazara and Doi murder scenes.
Richard Ramirez changes his MO for the next attack, this one in Burbank, California.
Richard uses a doggy door to gain entrance into the home of his latest victim, 42-year-old widow Carol Kyle.
Wake up, whore. Don't make a sound. Do what I say, you understand?
I'll give you whatever you want, just please. Don't hurt my children.
Children? How many?
My son and my daughter. But she stayed at a friend's last night.
Maybe I'll stay till morning.
She was able to work around whatever was going on in his head to convince him that the best course of action for her and her son was for him to allow them to live.
If I give you something valuable, will you leave?
Sure, I'll leave. What else? I know you got more. This is a nice place.
We're poor. My husband died. He left me nothing. I just have my kids. Please, don't hurt my son. He's been through so much already.
Okay. Just do what I say. You'll both be okay.
Carol Kyle survived the attack, but not before she was raped and sodomized while her son was handcuffed and locked in a closet.
By early June, after 6 murders, 2 attempted murders, and several assaults, the media coverage is growing. Angelinos shake in fear as they hear about the predator in their midst.
Everyone in the Los Angeles, Orange County area was afraid. Everyone kept their windows closed. Everyone was very cautious about where they were.
Richard Ramirez gets a small taste of fear himself when he gets pulled over by the police.
Richard got away, but again, he left a piece of evidence behind. This time, it was an appointment card for the dentist.
Within the first 3 weeks of July 1985, Richard Ramirez kills 4 more people. One of the deceased is found with an Avia shoe print on her face. Ramirez also brutally attacks 2 others without killing them. And one of the victims requires 478 stitches to her scalp. Richard inexplicably leaves them alive to tell their stories.
Investigators hope that another composite sketch will crack open the case. So they have one drawn after the attack on Carol Kyle.
I know this is frustrating, Miss Kyle. Is this the man you saw?
It doesn't look like him, but I couldn't get the artist to do any better. He was a Mexican guy with bad teeth. But good looking. But his teeth.
How about we get another? New artist. Hook it up, y'all. Thank you, Mrs. Kyle. Be in touch.
Carol Kyle's description of Richard helps police close in on their killer.
We were looking for, generally, the bad teeth. This guy had bad teeth to the point some witnesses said that, you know, he stunk.
Police talked to the dentist whose name was found on the appointment card left behind by the killer. They stake out his office, but their murder suspect is a no-show. The death toll continues to rise, and with each killing comes increasing viciousness and cruelty, such as the attack on the Abowaf family on August 8th. As Elias and Sakina Abowaf lay sleeping, Ramirez points his gun at Elias's head.
Let me go. Just please don't hurt us. Please, let me go.
Do what I say or else you're dead.
Yes, I will. I will.
Do you swear?
I swear.
Just... swear to Satan.
I just swear to Satan.
Swear to Satan.
Swear to Satan. Just let me go.
Shut that kid up now.
The lives of her children are spared, but her husband is killed, and she's repeatedly raped and sodomized.
Richard Ramirez has been unstoppable for over a year, but soon the hunter will become the hunted. Richard Ramirez is on a vicious rampage. The media has dubbed the elusive killer the Valley Intruder. Los Angeles is on edge, knowing that the murderer can strike at any time throughout the metropolitan area.
The scariest thing about Richard Ramirez was that he could strike anywhere. He seemed to be making random decisions about the places he was going. You could watch on TV and see his exploits in Hollywood, the Valley, San Francisco, all over Southern California, so no one felt safe.
An article profiling one of the lead detectives in the case, Frank Salerno, is published in the Los Angeles Times. And in it, he predicts the Valley Intruder will strike again.
Not long after, Richard Ramirez says just that. But this time, his victims live outside San Francisco. But the MO is the exact same.
On August 18th, 1985, Richard enters the home of Peter and Barbara Pan. He shoots Peter in the temple as he sleeps, killing him. Then he beats, sexually abuses, and shoots Barbara in the head. Richard uses lipstick to scrawl the phrase, "Jack the Knife," on the bedroom wall.
He had left pentagrams and satanic things on that at that crime scene.
After the latest murders, the media gives the killer a new nickname, the Night Stalker. As reports and police sketches circulate on the news, Richard plays a strange game with his friend, Donna Myers.
Hey, Donna. Do you think I'm the Night Stalker?
Hell no, Rick. You don't have the guts to kill anybody. You do fit that description to a T.
I know. That's why I had to leave L.A. I didn't want people thinking it was me.
During that visit, Richard surprises Donna, who suffers from pulmonary disease, with trophies from his crimes. But she doesn't immediately catch on as to what they are.
I need you to hold on to something for me. If you broke into someone's house and the people were inside, would you kill him?
They're never going to catch the psycho.
By the end of August, the Night Stalker's crimes are saturating the news. Richard returns to Southern California and is on the prowl once again when he's spotted by James Romero.
It appeared that Ramirez had been scoping the neighborhood, maybe looking for a location to hit.
He was using a burnt orange mini station wagon with a rack on top. And James Romero caught a partial license plate on the night he encountered Richard Ramirez.
James reports the partial plate number, 482T, to police. A short time later, not far away, Richard breaks into the home of 30-year-old Bill Carnes and his 29-year-old fiancée, Carol Smith. Bill Carnes miraculously survives 3 shots to the head and lays unconscious. Richard then turns his attention to Carol.
Do you know who I am?
No. Who are you?
I'm the Night Stalker.
Oh, God. No.
Don't say that. Say Satan. Say hello, Satan. Say it.
Say it.
Richard then proceeds to rape Carol. A few days later, Richard's stolen burnt orange Toyota is found abandoned near a shopping center. It contains the best clue yet.
It was the first time we got a fingerprint, and that was off the mirror.
Richard's friend Donna Myers watches a report about the Night Stalker. When it mentions that jewelry was stolen from the crime scenes, she tells police about the valuables that Richard gave her. They match the jewelry stolen during the San Francisco murders.
Police have a name, Richard Ramirez. And not long after that, they have a face to go with it. It's not long until Richard Ramirez's mugshot is everywhere. It saturates the airwaves. It's on the front page of newspapers. The hunt for the Night Stalker has reached a fever pitch.
In late August 1985, Richard Ramirez travels to Tucson, Arizona by bus to visit his brother in the midst of a media firestorm.
In Tucson, Richard doesn't get to see his brother, so he turns around and heads back to L.A.
As soon as he steps off the bus in L.A., Richard notices a huge police presence.
We put a surveillance on the bus depot, thinking if he's in town, which we had to believe he was, he may flee through the Greyhound bus depot.
While police watch the outgoing buses, Richard slips by.
Richard flees the bus station and then heads to a liquor store. While he's there at the liquor store, these older women look at him and see him and start saying, "Matador, Matador," which meant the killer.
El matador, el matador, el matador, el matador.
On his way out, Richard sees his mugshot on the front of a Spanish-language newspaper.
El Matador!
Ramirez then runs into the Los Angeles neighborhood of Boyle Heights, but he is quickly recognized there as well.
El Matador!
I need your car.
No! No, you monster! No!
He tried to steal a car because he wanted to get away, but he picked the wrong neighborhood.
The woman's husband is nearby and rushes to assist his wife, who is struggling with Richard.
Pretty soon, the entire neighborhood knew he was there. They knew it was the Night Stalker. They chased him down and beat him on the street.
There was a man with a bar who was going to finish him off. And his wife said to him, no, don't do this. But he was one strike away from, 30 seconds. I think the crowd would have killed him.
Police arrive moments later and make an arrest.
The LAPD saved Richard Ramirez's life.
By the time Ramirez arrives at the police station, word has spread like wildfire and a crowd is ready and waiting.
It was total chaos. You know, everyone knew that they were bringing the Night Stalker in. So there were people on fences, climbing all over the place, you know, shouting, chanting. It was like a party-like atmosphere. They walked us by, you know, the perp walk. And I took the pictures. You could see there was quite a bit of blood on his back. I guess he had been beaten pretty bad.
A few days later, Richard makes his first appearance in court. He hangs his head down to avoid being photographed.
But there's no escaping the glare of the cameras and the dozens of people who are at the courthouse trying to get a glimpse of the notorious Night Stalker.
You see that in case after case with killers, Bundy, Manson, all of them had these sort of acolytes showing up at court.
I love Richard and I know he's innocent.
One of Richard's most ardent and loyal supporters is a woman named Doreen Loy.
Doreen became pen pals with Richard after his arrest and stood by him through the trial.
By the time his arraignment is held the next month, Richard seems to have embraced his celebrity. In court, he's defiant. He shows a pentagram on his hand and yells a salute to Satan as he's led away.
He's safe.
Richard Ramirez will soon have his day in court, but with another secret admirer on the jury, will the Night Stalker be set free to kill again? By the time his trial gets underway in 1988, Richard Ramirez, also known as the Night Stalker, has gained notoriety and a twisted level of fame.
Strangely enough, Richard Ramirez crossed paths with celebrities while he was behind bars. Sean Penn was in the same jail for punching an extra and for reckless driving, and Richard Ramirez asked him for an autograph. Also, Todd Bridges, who was the star of Different Strokes, was in the same jail, and he said in his memoirs that Richard Ramirez would rattle the door to his cell and tell him that he was going to get him.
Richard takes on the persona of a rock star Satanist and frequently shows up in court with dark aviator sunglasses. Alternate juror Cindy Hayden gets her chance to sit in on the jury when another juror is dismissed. During the trial, Richard appears to pay close attention to Cindy.
It raises a lot of questions of how did they interact and were they interacting at the time of trial?
The trial lasts more than a year. During that time, Ramirez often plays to the cameras.
Richard was always making the devil sign. He would look back at the media on purpose.
He shows little respect for the proceedings.
There was gruesome testimony on how Richard Ramirez had gouged out the eyes of his victim, Maxine Zazara. And if you looked at him in court, Richard Ramirez was smiling and at one point appeared to laugh.
Prosecutors present over 100 witnesses and over 500 pieces of evidence before the court rests and the case goes to the jury. After 22 days of deliberations, on September 20th, 1989, Ramirez is convicted of 13 counts of murder, 5 attempted murders, 11 sexual assaults, and 14 burglaries. Less than 2 months later, the Night Stalker is sentenced to die in the gas chamber. At sentencing, Richard addresses the court.
Legions of the Nightbreed, repeat not the errors of Night Father and show no mercy. I will be avenged. Lucifer dwells within us all. That's it.
He also displays his indifference to his sentencing and the massacre he left in his wake.
Big deal. Death always went with the territory. Even this man.
Before Richard is sent to death row, Frank Salerno and his partner, Gil Carrillo, finally get the chance to talk to him.
Spent 10 days with Richard after he was convicted and sentenced, and before he was sent to death row. And our purpose was to see if we could learn if there were any more cases out there.
You believe in Satan?
I believe there is a divine force out there. I also believe there's a malevolent force out there. Perhaps they're one and the same.
Have you always felt that way?
Your parents bring you up in the Church of Satan?
He said, I tried God and it didn't work, so I thought I'd try Satan.
Despite promising to reveal details, Richard refuses to give specifics about himself or his crimes.
Serial killers, they will make these promises of I'm going to reveal this set of details or that set of details in the hopes that they will get some sort of power back. But generally speaking, what happens is that they can't bear the thought of giving up that little bit of power.
In prison, Richard receives visits from his many female admirers.
Richard loved the attention from groupies.
None are as devoted to Richard, however, as Doreen Loy and juror Cindy Hayden. Cindy Hayden becomes a private detective just so she can work on Richard's case. But it's Doreen who captures the heart of the serial killer. On October 3rd, 1996, Richard and Doreen marry at California's San Quentin State Prison. In 2009, 20 years after his conviction, DNA technology links Richard to the rape and murder of 9-year-old Mae Lung in San Francisco. She is believed to be his first victim.
Because he was already on death row, no new charges were filed.
As Richard awaits execution, he has one last question for Frank Salerno.
So, Frank, are you going to come to my execution? I said, yes, I am. That was it.
Death comes 3 years later, but not by execution. On June 7th, 2013, Richard is hospitalized and dies of liver failure from B-cell lymphoma.
I think the summary of Ramirez is that there is a really deep level of tragedy.
He and people like him are almost made into heroes by the media coverage and by what is written about them. But unfortunately, Richard Ramirez is nothing more than a killer.
That concludes this episode of Murder Made Me Famous. Don't forget to go to Reels.com, that's R-E-E-L-Z.com, for clips, extras, and more. And check out new episodes every Saturday on the Reels channel. Don't forget to subscribe on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts.
You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person, too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in-line and online. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/truecrime.